Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Tom Dongo. Before I bring him on, I have to thank C60 Purple Power. You should know by now the benefits of C60. By everything that I've been telling you, every time I talk about C60, the amazing health benefits, please go to their website and check it out for yourself, c60purplepower.com, or click the link in the description. You can use coupon code KNOWLEDGE10, and you will get 10% off your order, plus free shipping. I feel amazing, I feel great, and you should too. Also, check out Karen Holton. She offers not only health and spiritual coaching, but some amazing orgone generators and domes, some comfort crystals, some amazing services. Click the link in the description also to check out her website. Tonight, I want to welcome Tom Dongo. He is the author of 8 books, recognized as one of America's leading authorities as a paranormal UFO ET researcher, remote viewer, and over the course of many years been a key lecturer at numerous U.S. national and international conferences, including the International UFO Congress. He studied at the Berkeley International Psychic Institute in Santa Cruz, California, and has spent the last 30 years in the greater Sedona, Arizona area, which is known as one of the premier UFO hotspots of the world. Tom, welcome. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm doing great. Glad to be here on your show.
Thank you so much for joining us. I've been looking forward to it because you've spent so many years researching this phenomenon and even had many of your own unexplained experiences. But the field of ufology is extremely complex, especially now with so many differing viewpoints when it comes to this and not only the UFO phenomenon, but paranormal and high strangeness in general. And you can also now add the recent information coming from our own military sources and mainstream media, who, of course, you can always trust and believe. But what I'd like to start with tonight is what got you involved with ufology and psychic phenomenon?
Well, I get asked that often, but I really had no interest in UFOs and so forth until I was in my 40s, about 45. I had a few UFO sightings. I grew up in Maine, in Falmouth, Maine, and I had some very strange UFO sightings back when I was about 19 years old with red lights flying around in the sky. So I really didn't even know what a UFO was. So I just took note of it and remembered it. And one in particular, I'll never forget. I walked out my door one night and there was a red light. I was right on the edge of a broad valley, and at the bottom of this valley was a power line, a main power line through the state, high power lines. And I saw this. It was a crimson red. I've seen it many times, this crimson red. And it slowly was going down, and I lost it in the trees, but then it would come back up and just hang there in the air for a while. And it did it again. It went down and it came up, and then it went down and it stayed down. This later on, I found out that the UFOs were draining the power out of these high power lines, and this was a main power line for the state.
And when went north, when was this again?
Would have been about 1964.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, I later learned I was going to drive down there just as the heck of it, see. And I later learned I've interviewed about 500 people that have had UFO and contactee experiences, and I would have been a fool to go down there because that's how people have missing time. So I'm glad I didn't go down there because it's a real lonely spot. There's really no houses down there. So at any rate, I'm glad I didn't go down. It might not have been too good. I've seen probably 400 now in the intervening time. I'm 75 now, so I've been at this for a long, long time. I've seen about 400 or 500 UFOs. Some were metal crafts. Most of them were discs or orbs. And usually, if it's a big orb, if it's 50 feet across, That's when the ship's propulsion systems are fired up to the full. There's a ball of energy that surrounds the ship, and it's usually orange, red, white, but usually orange. I've seen many, many of those, and I've seen the ship stop, and the glow around the ship dissipates slowly, and then you see a disc. I've seen it many times. And actually, just to poke this story in here, I don't think I've ever told it, but Bob Short was a great friend of mine. He died about 2 years ago, and he was in with Van Tassel, George Van Tassel, and George Adamski, and all those guys. In fact, his wife was a good friend of George Adamski. So anyway, Bob told me this story one time. He was down in the Arizona desert near Phoenix, and then it was extremely desolate. This would have been probably in the early 50s. There were nothing. There was nothing there. No housing developments or anything in that area. Now there's a million houses down there. But he was driving along, and this orange ball of light flew over him, so he said to himself, "What the heck is that?" And it landed. It came down right off the side of the road, left side of the road, so Bob pulled off the road, and by then, the orange glow had dissipated, and it was a disc, a silver disc. So Bob got out of his car, and he told me this story probably 30 years ago. I can still remember exactly how he said it. But anyway, he walked over to this disc, and it was about, I think he said, 60 feet across. So a hatch opened up, and Bob was right next to the ship, and a voice said, "Don't touch the ship." So this ramp comes down, and this guy walks out, and he's a human extraterrestrial. My estimation is there are about 15 races of human extraterrestrials mixed in with the humanoids. There are about 150 total that are on this planet now or are coming and going from this planet, and this number is growing all the time. But recently, a top UFO researcher that's been in this as long as I have claimed there are far more. There are about 50 human races of human extraterrestrials. I would really disagree with that, because I know of just about all the human extraterrestrials that have come and go on this planet, and I only know of 12 or 15. I've interviewed 10 people that had face-to-face contacts with these human extraterrestrials. They all have come back from it, saying it was wonderful. These people are wonderful. So anyway, this Bob's walking over to the ship, and he heard a voice that said, "Don't touch the ship. You'll be burned severely." So this guy comes out. I don't think Bob. I guess it was just kind of an idle chit chat. They just talked for a while. And the guy that got out of the ship didn't say where he was from, or I don't remember if Bob told me. But they talked for about a half an hour, and I remember the guy introduced himself, the alien. And Bob had had he was Bob Short was one of the first. He was there were six people that were pioneers of UFO research, and Bob Short was one of them. And now Bob Short was the last one. He died a year and a half ago. And he lived near me here in Cottonwood, Arizona. I lived in Sedona for 32 years. I've been in Cottonwood now for 3. So Bob is the last one. He said, I'm the last one. They're all gone. And so all the pioneers are gone now. So after I left Maine, I moved to California when I was 23. I lived in different places around California, Santa Cruz, Lake Tahoe, and I was in the snow ski business for many years. So then I got real tired of California, the BMWs and the Porsches and whatever and the high money, the big money crowd. So I thought, well, I'm getting out of here. I'm going to move to Arizona. And I didn't even know what it looked like. So I had some friends that lived in Sedona, and that's a good enough place. You know, I thought it was like Phoenix, all sand and cactus, right? And bushes and poisonous snakes. So I got to Sedona. I said, wow, this is pretty decent. I didn't know it looked like this, you know, because Sedona is one of the most scenic places on the earth with the,
right.
the red, yeah, the great red rocks, you know, and all that. It's world famous now. I just mentioned Sedona and everybody knows about Sedona. So I was here for a while and I had experiences before that. I'll go back. I always tell this story because I get asked it so much. How did you get into this? Totally into it. I said, and I've told this story 1,000 times and I never get tired of it. But I was on a lunch break from, I had a store in Reno, a sporting goods store that was mostly skis. And I was going down the sidewalk one day and this giant pair of hands grabbed me. I mean, I'm talking giant from my hips to my shoulders, big, big hands. So I'm saying, this is kind of weird, but you know, I'm not, you know, nothing freaks me out. We could be here for the next 2 days talking about scary things I've been involved in, and almost nothing scares me. So anyway, these hands grab me, you know, I'm being steered down the sidewalk, and so it steers me into the hands steer me into this parking lot, and I'm going in between cars, you know, the hands are taking me this way and that way, and I'm going, well, what the heck, this is kind of fun. I got across the parking lot, and I saw a bookstore. I went through the door. My hands are navigating me through the aisles, and I got to the back of the store, and the hands bent me over. It was a rack of used books, and on the bottom was and this book got me into this. I owe everything I do to this book. It was Seth Speaks by Jane Roberts, and it's a channeled book. And it was an incredibly intelligent book, one of the most intelligent things. So Seth was an incredible intellect that Jane Roberts channeled. So at any rate, I studied that book for 6 months, and that's really what got me into this whole thing. So then I go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's very fascinating, the story of how you were led to the book. I wanted to ask you your thoughts on when it comes to the ET contact and abduction phenomenon. There is so many aspects to it, and from I've interviewed many different abductees and contactees that have been involved with this, and you hear, I guess from my side, I've heard equal positive experiences to negative experiences, and different accounts of, you know, how the actual event occurred, what types of beings were there, and my overall view, it seems if this phenomenon is actually occurring, and I've actually had my own, you know, contact experience, that it, you know, humans, you know, seem to be some kind of experiment or something that is being monitored in some type of way. Is this something you would agree with?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I use this all the time. I had this discussion with Linda Moulton Howe, and you know, Charles Fort, when he stopped doing, he was the first paranormal researcher. And when Charles Fort quit, all he had for research resources were newspaper clippings and magazine articles. That's all he had. Look at the stuff we've got. We've got everything now these days. That's all he had was newspaper articles. So he came to the last thing Charles Fort said, and I stick with this even now, and so does Linda Howe to a certain extent. But Charles Fort said, we are somebody's herd of cattle. And I agree with that totally, because I think you know, they're in a way they're harvesting people, you know, it gets real strange. There are good extraterrestrials and there are bad extraterrestrials, and I am an expert remote viewer. I was born with a fantastic remote viewing ability, so I can probe some of these things, you know, the humanoids are a little real strange. Some of them are millions of years ahead of us, so naturally they'd regard us as ants. I try to make people aware of this as much as I can, because of what I'm going to get ready to teach my version of remote viewing. But people, if there were more remote viewers, there'd be far less problems. Because for one thing, there would be no secrets. You could read people's minds. And you can also talk to extraterrestrials. I've done it many times. I talked to some of the world's experts on these things. It's not that hard, especially if you're a good remote viewer. But I can name a few. Well, I won't name them, but very, very, famous people that talk to extraterrestrials. Some face to face, physically. I do it remote viewing, and I know their language. You know, they're telepathic. Very few of them speak like we do. Words. They speak. They have a telepathic language that they project pictures to you to talk. So it's up to us, me, whoever, to a picture's worth a thousand words, and it is. So sometimes I can't figure out what the heck they told me. So I said, I can't read. I can't see it. I don't understand it. You have to do it again. So they do. You know, they're really patient with us little ant people, humans. They really are. They have an amazing patience. If you go to the bother of contacting them, and I've been face to face with the worst of them. You know, people are always saying, well, what about the bad guys? You know, the bad guys and the good guys. That drives me nuts, because the bad ones, if I have been face to face with them, you know, and if you recognize them, they will recognize you and they'll leave you alone. You know, it's the people that are totally oblivious. That's what the problem is today. We're not progressing fast enough. I mean, now there's a scientific theory that we're in a parallel world. There's a parallel Earth. A lot of the problems we have are going on in this parallel Earth. And it goes back and forth, and I would agree with that completely. I had a meeting the other day with a physicist. I'm really proud of this. I've talked to some of the most brilliant people on this planet, knowledgeable people, lots of them. And this guy, this physicist, his name was Mark Wentz, and he was one of the smartest people I've ever. He was versed on everything, so I loved every second of it, because he pressed me to the outer limits. He pressed me as hard as he could, and I pressed him as hard as he could, because of the knowledge he possessed, and it was vast. I mean, he kept bringing up stuff that I knew a lot about, but the pieces I didn't know, but he knew those pieces, like Montauk. We really got into Montauk. And Bigfoot, he's a real big Bigfoot fan. I've been a Bigfoot researcher since I was 16. But I had a lot of people probably don't even know what Montauk was. I had some people went there and investigated it. And the story in Montauk is that they were fooling around with time travel, and they brought a monster back with them. Somehow this thing got into the time stream, coming back to the ship and really tore the place to pieces. Montauk, New York, the island, evidently is completely open now, but it was such an emergency. Somebody went out with an axe and chopped these 8-inch cables, cable bundles going into the ground to supply the underground structure. They were chopped with, I've got the photographs of them. There was such an emergency that somebody chopped them with an axe. Didn't cut them, you know, with a torch or a hacksaw. It was chopped with an axe. So, whatever it was, the emergency of Montauk, it was a real super emergency. So anyway, that's. Then I moved to Sedona, and I was running into all sorts of UFO and alien stuff here. And so I started poking around. And since in the preceding times, I've written 8 books, and my new one is doing Merging Dimensions is doing very well. It's about Sedona and the Bradshaw Ranch. So,
yeah, I want to get to that. I definitely do. Yeah. Before we do, I want to talk a little bit about these actual races of extraterrestrials, that some that you have even made contact with, when you're talking about either malevolent or benevolent beings, Talk a little bit about maybe some of the contact that you've had and some of the races that you know of that are interacting with humans right now and possibly, you know, have been for thousands of years.
Well, they're all dealing with us one way or another. And I'll stick to my estimate of 15 races. And there's probably about 125 races of humanoids. They're not human. I'll stick to that from my own research, from Colonel Corso on a day after Roswell, and the 71 that the Army intelligence people knew about when Corso was a colonel in Army intelligence. 71 races they knew of. So, and I've been told that the U.S. government knows of a lot more, and I've been able to remote view I know what the U.S. government knows. I know what they know because I remote viewed them. They don't bother. They don't seem to care anymore. They don't. So anyway, I know the extraterrestrials that they've been dealing with, and Linda Moulton House, when I talked about this, God bless her, boy, she's incredible. But she has contacts everywhere, far far more than I do. But she had in the Pentagon. There was a story that. And Linda always validates her stuff, you know, if she can. And in the Pentagon, a pretty high-ranking soldier, I think he was a captain. Anyway, he found out what the government knows about extraterrestrials, and he got kind of pissed off. So he went to his superior, which was probably a colonel, and said, you know, this is nuts. I mean, we've got to tell the public what we know. And the guy patiently said, sit down, son, sit down, calm yourself. So he said, listen, I know what you know, and we will never, ever tell the American people what we know about extraterrestrials. Never, ever tell them. What's that institute? I've got it written down here somewhere. But anyway, there's an institute. The government hired this institute about 25 years ago, very very prestigious institute to do research on the government told them what they knew about extraterrestrials, and they said go out and do a survey, to see what the reaction the public would have. I mean, this is 30 years ago, so I'm sure now it'd be quite a bit different. So they went out and interviewed the public and did some research, and they came back 6 months later and said, don't tell them anything. Because for two reasons, the world economy would collapse within days and there would be a revolution amongst the religions. He said, don't tell them anything. So that's what started it with the government, you know, not revealing what they know. And I don't blame them. I think the reaction would be horrendous. I mean, it wouldn't. For people, you know, that you know, listeners here and you and me, we'd be fine with it. But the Joe Sixpack, you know, it would be hell. So I can clearly understand why, you know, they wouldn't reveal these things, you know. But so at any rate, what I talk about these days, I wouldn't have dared to talk about 5 years ago. So everything's changing fast. But is it going to change fast enough? You know, are we? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead and finish your thought.
Yeah, no. I if you don't stop me, I'll ramble on till 3 o'clock. If 3 o'clock in the morning, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that you know, with what everything we're seeing coming now from the mainstream media and all these you know, Pentagon videos, the Tic Tac, all these new things that are coming out right now that people have been paying attention to, you would have hoped that more people would at least be open to the idea of, you know, the UFO phenomenon and being a little bit more prepared. And I think that could be a part of the reason why this is popping up more in the mainstream. I'm not sure completely, and I don't trust the sources, but I think that may be a possibility why we're seeing a little bit more of this stuff. What do you think's going on with the uptick of the information that's coming out of the mainstream media about UFOs?
Oh, you know, we all know that the mainstream media is being manipulated by just a handful of people now. They're owned and manipulated by a handful. So they choose what we see,
right,
and hear. Yeah, you know, and so, you know, I have inside sources, and some of them have come forward, and some of them have died. Before they died, they told, you know, they told me everything, right? And some of these were high-ranking military people. Not just me, lots of people, some of them, but they, a lot of these, like that Tic Tac thing, those are our ships. You know, everybody's all, the Pentagon's revealing these UFO secrets. No, they're not. Those are our ships. Why do I say that? Because I know that we've had our own flying saucers for 50 years, at least 50 years. We've been flying our own flying saucers. And I so a lot of the stuff we see flying around, especially the arrowhead shaped ships, those are ours.
Right.
And they had that big blue light on the bottom. Those are ours. In fact, one of those flew over a guy with a PhD in Texas. And he said it said U.S. Air Force right on the bottom of it. You know, and it didn't make a sound. So they've had our government, probably the Soviets too, have had anti-gravity craft, and they've been flying them. I had a guy tell me, we have been to the stars. We have been to most of the stars, and he said now with the speed of light is too slow, 230,000 miles per second. He said it was too slow. We have ships now that can fly at the speed of thought, and I've been mulling this over for years. The speed of thought is incredible, because I've done it with remote viewing. I mean, you can go, you know, 1,000 light years in seconds. So anyway, and you know, Stanton Friedman, the nuclear physicist, was one of my best friends. I mean, we were great friends. You know, a nuclear physicist, and he, 600 times, you know, I get criticized for this, but you know, at any rate, so you know, people tell me, oh, no big deal, I've known that. Yeah, well, fine. Why don't you talk about it? Prove it. Anyway, so Stan Friedman did 600 times. He did this same damned interview, the speech that he did 600 times at universities around the world. And Stan's whole thing, I could do it in 5 minutes. He would take this piece of paper, flat out, and fold it. And he would say, this is how extraterrestrials fly through space. They fold time and fold space. And he says they don't fly through this whole 8 inches of flat paper. They fly through the fold. It's just, and he said, and that's what they do. It's a matter of half a day to go tens of thousands of light years. And that was Stan's whole spiel, and I'm sure he got paid an awful lot of money for that. You know, at a university, they pay pretty good. So anyway, Stan, 600 times he did that same damn speech. You know, and I heard it a couple of times. So anyway, Stan Friedman was a wonderful guy. He was a nuclear physicist, so he's a little weird. But me, I'll tell you a story about Stan. I was interviewed with Stan Friedman one time about 20 years ago. And Stan Friedman is the most steely-eyed stare you can imagine. And the cameraman had me stare at Stan Friedman's eyes and his face. I started laughing. I couldn't help it. Because he was just so damn serious, you know, and his eyes are just boring into me. And I just couldn't stop laughing. And Stan was, that's what began our friendship. We were good friends after that. But so that was my experience with Stan Friedman. I wish there were more people like him. You know, the great ones are passing away. The really great ones, you know, the last of the great ones are leaving. There are only a few left.
Yeah, it is a very sad thing, but you know, we've had many greats come and go. Now, earlier you had mentioned the Bradshaw Ranch, and I want to talk a little bit about that, because there are some profound connections when it comes to ufology and the world of, like, cryptids and strange creatures like that. And even Bigfoot, we have some UFO sightings associated with Bigfoot. And from what I hear at the Bradshaw Ranch, there's a whole assortment of activity that has occurred there. And you've actually done some investigation on it. Tell us, for those that aren't familiar with the, it's the Stardust Ranch, correct?
Well, there's the big the Bradshaw Ranch is when I spent 4.5 years out there with the Bradshaws. There's the Bradshaw Ranch, the Stardust Ranch, which I won't have anything to do with it. Nothing. I know all about it, and I won't have anything to do with it for various reasons. And then the Skinwalker Ranch. I'm in close contact with the Skinwalker Ranch guys, and it's totally different between Skinwalker Ranch, Bradshaw Ranch, and Stardust.
So for the Bradshaw Ranch, tell us about what, you know, a little bit about what you were involved with and some of the happenings there.
Well, Linda, we had camera crews from all over the world that came out there once this thing got going. But I had heard rumors. This was just when I was doing research on UFOs. And various weird things. I've always said the weirder it is, the better I like it. You know, that's kind of the way it is. So anyway, I heard these stories about Bradshaw Ranch, and I'd never been out there, and I wanted to go out. So I got a letter from Linda Bradshaw. She said, "We've got some strange stuff going on here, and you're kind of famous in UFO world and whatnot." And she said, "Will you come out and take a look?" And I said, "Oh, sure." I was thrilled. In fact, I probably still got the letter around here somewhere. So the next day I went out and I spent 4.5 years there with Linda and Bob, three or four nights a week. I was out there for 4.5 years. And so she showed me Linda Bradshaw and Linda Crystal in Pine Bush, New York, were the ones that discovered orbs. Linda Crystal and Linda Bradshaw. And Linda had photographs of orbs. I mean, there had been photographs of orbs in the world, around the world, but not. I give credit to Linda Bradshaw and Linda Crystal for pioneering orb research. And so Linda and I Linda Bradshaw and I definitely pioneered orb research, because they're most of them are living beings. Yeah, they have a limited amount of intelligence, not anything like we have. They've probably been here for millions of years. I'm sure they have. So at any rate, there's something else I don't want to forget to talk about before I get through with this. So Linda and I, we after about 2 years on the ranch, we had these things flying around, these orbs, and we really thought they were landing lights. They were landing at the Cottonwood Airport. So one night I said, "Linda, you know, I don't think those are landing lights." So we had very poor financial resources. We couldn't afford much. And the Bradshaws owned that big ranch, but they had very little cash. Same with me. So we had very little stuff to research with. And we begged studios to give us, you know, any kind of scientific, you know, stuff you can give us. And none of them ever would. They get shot down. We get shot down every time. So anyway, the orbs. We had 3.5 million candle power spotlights, rechargeable spotlights. So we started flashing at these orbs that were flying around, you know, maybe a mile away from us, and they started to respond. And we knew then these things weren't, you know, they were something very, very different. And we would do Morse code stuff, you know, flash, 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 2, 3, 3, 4, 5, you know. And they would respond. They'd flash back in the same sequence. So we knew we were really onto something then. And they were like timid wild animals. They would come closer. And Linda was good at getting them to come close. They would come close to her. Actually, one time, they lined up on the ridge above the ranch. And I tried to take a picture of it, but we only had cheap 35-millimeter cameras. I mean, if we had a you know, even a cell phone camera now, we could have gotten good photographs of those things. And we didn't have a video camera because they weren't out, good ones that weren't out yet then. But I have two Sony cameras They're high eight. They were obsolete a year after I bought them. They're both brand new, but they're high eight and zero lux. And they, anything the human eye can see at night, those cameras will film. They're incredible. So anyway, we didn't have video cameras, so we did the best we could with spotlights and 35 millimeter film cameras. And the orbs would come close to us. And somebody wrote a book, somebody with a PhD, a few years afterwards, somebody in New York, and I can't remember his name. I'm sure plenty of people out there can, but he wrote a book about orbs, and he said they have the intelligence about that of a dog, you know, a dog. So, and I would agree, they were like timid wild animals, is the way they reacted. Linda, we finally did get a camera, a video camera that would film, camcorder that would film at night. And Linda, we did this a lot. We'd walk forward, but take pictures behind us with flash and whatnot. And so Linda had videotaped one. She's walking forward back to the ranch. She put the camera behind her and turned it on. And there was an orb, a white, about an 8-inch glowing white orb following her about 10 feet behind her. It was sneaking from tree to tree, but it was right behind her. And so what Linda and I did, what we originated nighttime flash photography, because what a camera can see 80% more than the human eye can see. I've got a video that explains that. But we have us humans have a very narrow range of sight of what we can see. Something might be right in front of us, but we can't see it, but the camera can. That you on a flash, you take a flash picture, and then and digital, it's instant. If you got something on digital, it's right there. It doesn't cost anything. But we 35 millimeter film got really expensive, so we would just buy rolls and not develop it, but just develop the negative, and then look at fluorescent light, we'd look at the negative, see if there's anything in the negative, then we would develop it. So that's how we got into this. And it kind of blossomed from there. And Bob Bradshaw he bought the ranch in 1949, and it was 190 acres. It was 90 acres when they sold it. But Bob Bradshaw, he was a good old redneck Arizona cowboy. He was out one day and. A UFO landed right in front of him, a disc, and it had about 100 orbs around it. And this was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It came over the hill, landed on the ranch. So that was enough for Bob. He was on national TV talking about this twice. He was real nervous talking about it. After that night, he would not come out. Linda would go, you know, we couldn't get him out. He'd stay inside and watch TV. And Linda would go in, you know, say, Bob, you got to come out. You got to see what this is. You got to see this thing. He wouldn't. Nope, I'm not coming out. So anyway, it went on from there. And we had camera crews from all over the world, everywhere in the world. And we tried to get them to donate or whatever scientific equipment to us. And they could have, we said, you can have all the rights to what we film while we have this stuff. And the crews would go back to the studios. Like I remember Universal Studios really well because the camera crew had seen the things we saw, and they were really gung-ho about it. And they got back to the Universal Studios, and they got shot down big time. And that happened every single time with the camera crew. So we ended up, using very inadequate equipment when we should have had scientific stuff on the ranch because we knew it was going to end suddenly.
Hello, Tom.
Yeah, Chris, hey. It just went dead. What happened?
I'm not sure. You got cut off there. That was very strange. The line just went off. But you, I remember where you were. You were talking about the filming at the Bradshaw Ranch, how you really didn't have the adequate equipment that you needed to capture some of the phenomenon that was happening. I was wondering if you could kind of pick up from there and tell us about some of the more profound phenomenon that was occurring on the ranch, you know, that you were either able to capture or witness yourself.
Yeah, so we didn't lose much then, maybe a couple of minutes. It was so, you know, my new book, Merging Dimensions, merging. It's not emerging. It's merging with an M, Merging Dimensions. But most of the best of my photographs that I took on the Bradshaw Ranch are in that book. The new ones, the best of the best, are in the new version of Merging Dimensions, and they are incredible. And I don't know how I could describe some of these because they're so unusual, you know. So I'll kind of explain a little bit what I can about this. But we probably just south of the ranch house, maybe 20 feet, about 20 feet in the air, there was a portal. We could feel it, and Linda was a better psychic than I was. We could feel things coming through this portal. There's something I want to talk about that I don't want to forget because it just happened. I got 20 things on my mind at once. My mouth is always 3 seconds ahead of my mind, so bear with me. Anyway, these things would come through this portal, and we knew that they could see us, but we couldn't see them. And they were probably from another dimension. We would take flash pictures, and a lot of the stuff that's in my book, that's how we got it. We take a flash picture, and the next day develop the film, and we'd see there's something on there that we didn't see, but the camera got it. Strange things like. One night, and this stuff defies explanation. It really does. It's so strange. Linda and I, just by sheer chance, flashed at the same time. Both cameras, we flashed it at exactly the same time, which is almost impossible to do. And there was in above us, maybe 10 feet above us, was a white feather. It was about 15 feet long, and we both got it. We could see it, but it didn't record on the cameras. And it was Linda and I said this many, many times. I say, Linda, if you didn't see that the same time I did, I would for sure think I was insane. And she said, yeah, me too. If you hadn't been in and witnessed what I just saw, I would think I was nuts too. So this happened time after time after time there. And Bigfoot, there was Bigfoot activity there, and it still is. It's still ongoing. It's just a few weeks ago, the Bradshaw Ranch now is in ruins. The U.S. government bought the Bradshaw Ranch, all 90 acres, and then the ranch buildings were abandoned. Now everything's in ruins. The doors are smashed in, the windows are smashed in, there's graffiti on the walls, the weeds are waist high, so they're going to bulldoze the ranch houses and build the University of Northern the University of Northern Arizona is going to build a dormitory there and do native Arizona plant research there to see how the weather affects them, rains, you know, whatever. So they haven't done it yet, so they're about a year overdue on that because they probably read my books and, you know, found out how strange it is there. So the Bigfoot. Just a couple of weeks ago, people can still get on the Bradshaw Ranch. They don't have guards there anymore for some reason. So they can just walk right onto the ranch. But there was a Bigfoot handprint on somebody's car. and it hasn't rained hardly any for 6 months here. So, but it was wet, and this has happened twice that I know of. Is it somebody playing a prank? Absolutely not, because there's nobody near that, and nobody's going to go to the trouble of, you know, getting a big muddy hand and putting a handprint on a person's car, and a huge handprint. And so there was Linda Bradshaw. I always say I had a hard time with this, with the super strange stuff that happened on the Bradshaw Ranch. I had a lot of problems with Linda's Bigfoot. She named Big Girl. It was a white Bigfoot. I had a lot of trouble with that, even with the incredible things that happened. So Linda would leave food out for the, in a place where only something 8 feet tall could reach. You know, nothing else could get to it. And so she'd come out the next day, and all the food would be gone, grapes, bananas, whatever she left, and it would be sticks, you know, the ground underneath it would be cleared out, and then sticks would be ranged in a certain pattern, and Bigfoot do that. So I tell this story every radio show I'm on. The ranch hands thought we were nuts. I mean, they thought we were real fruitcakes, you know, and they were good at criticizing us. You know, I'm used to that. I've had it done to me millions of times now. But at any rate, I love this story. They really thought we were nuts, you know, some real fruitcakes. And anyway, so they went deer hunting. Three of those ranch hands went hunting on the ranch one day. And Linda says she saw them going, you know, disappearing a couple hundred yards away. And then she heard this blood-curdling scream. And it was the Bigfoot. The Big Girl, the Bigfoot, because Bigfoot do not like guns, clearly, and they're very gentle creatures. They are not violent creatures at all, unless they've been shot or something. So anyway, a few minutes later, these three guys come back running the 100-yard dash with their guns, burst into the living room, threw the guns into the corner, ran out yelling, "We believe, we believe!" They went, got to the pickup, went in town, and got drunk.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Bigfoot phenomenon, that's another one that I still can't wrap my head around, and I believe that there needs so much more evidence and more research to be done on this, because it does tie into so many of the other strange phenomenon that's occurred. If you look at testimony, some of the testimony from, you know, books like Missing 411, David Pilates' book, where people would just go missing from the forest, or they'd see UFOs before these strange encounters with these creatures. Yep. So it seems to be linked in some kind of way.
Well, I've got evidence, so much evidence on UFOs, and I could, I'm actually start thinking about writing a story about all true Bigfoot incidents I know of that I've been able to research and validate. And one of the strangest is, I could go on for the next hour telling Bigfoot stories, true Bigfoot stories that I've been able to validate. One was, this guy was telling me, and most of these people I talk to, 99% of them are absolutely normal, rational, you know, everyday people with nothing to gain by telling me these stories. They know they're not gonna be famous, they're not gonna make a lot of money. But anyway, this one guy, I can't remember him now. I haven't seen him for a while, but I knew him really well. But a couple of years ago, he told me this story about his grandparents in Kentucky. It was about 1885. They had a little cabin in the mountains in Kentucky. And that's where they lived. They trapped, they grew vegetables and whatnot. So a young Bigfoot showed up. You know, in some of these places, the Bigfoot they're taken for granted. I mean, they're just nothing unusual whatsoever. I could tell stories for the next hour about that kind of stuff. But so anyway, this young Bigfoot showed up, and it was cold. They could tell it was really cold, and it was very, very gentle. It was very, you know, it was a really not threatening at all. So they could tell it wanted to come in, because it was warm in the cabin. And evidently this went on, he said this went on all winter. The Bigfoot would come to the door, they let him in, or her, and it would go over by the stove and just stand there. Not touch anything. Just get warm, get good and warm, and then go out. And if it wouldn't go out, she'd chase it out with a broom, smack it with a broom. And, you know, so that it sounds crazy, but it isn't. That's what I know many stories like that. And some of them have come from the CIA. I can tell some CIA stories about Bigfoot. So anyway, that's one of the strangest. And how much time we got?
Well, we got a few more minutes. We got about 10, 15 more minutes. But I do want to go into a direction that you touched on earlier about how much the military knows and how much of this technology that we're seeing in the skies is the military, and how far in the stars have we gone? Have we gone to the moon? Have we gone beyond to Mars, to different solar systems? How advanced do you think we are here already? And do you think we are actually, you know, working with possible off-world entities or extraterrestrials?
Okay, there's one guy, his first name is Frank. He was he had a cosmic top secret clearance. I know about five people that have or had cosmic top secret clearance. That's 40 levels higher than the president of the United States, so it's pretty high. But he was saying, he wrote a book, and the publisher gave it to me to proofread. And I said, you know, well, I'll take a shot at it, but I'll correct any obvious errors if there is any. So anyway, he was saying, come on, you know, in the intelligence networks, naval intelligence, army intelligence, and I know a few of them. He's saying the U.S. government has been dealing face to face with extraterrestrials since the early 40s, and probably into about 1935. He says we all know it. So, and they've been dealing and trading, whatnot, trading information, equipment, whatnot. You know, since 1943, and Hitler was clearly. I mean, we get going on that. Hitler. Clearly was dealing with extraterrestrials towards the end. I've seen photographs of the ships that they've been flying. And I have a friend that was a top level government person. And he said, we have bases on Mars. I've been there. We have bases on the moon. And we aren't the only ones on the moon. And he said he didn't want to talk about the moon too much, but he says, no, that we, this is, people just don't know. And, you know, Ben Rich, who just died recently, he was the chairman of Lockheed Aircraft.
Right.
And he said, and this is absolute truth. And this is just scratching the surface. He said, whatever you know or think you know, we're 2,000 years ahead of that. Just use your imagination. We've got stuff that the aliens have, but they're not, you know, we've had anti-gravity for 50 years, but we're still flying jets that burn fossil fuel. It's nuts because I'll tell you a quick story. Otis T. Carr and Otis T. Carr built a, they had, back in the 60s, they built three flying saucers, and they were flying them. And Grant, I can't remember Frank's name, but at any rate, so one day the military showed up, and they just had a test flight of one of these things, anti-gravity. They were powered by crystals. So the military says, if you fly those again, we'll shoot them down. And so Otis T. Carr said, why? Because if we let you build those things commercially, you will put hundreds of thousands of people out of work in the petroleum business and the airline business. That was what they said.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty perplexing how much the technology that we could be seeing right now that could absolutely change the course of human history, change the way we travel, change the way we live, our health, economy, everything, for the better. but we wouldn't see these technologies because they're probably using them for their own nefarious purposes
absolutely,
that we're seeing right now.
Well, you know the book Stranger at the Pentagon by Dr. Frank Stranges, right?
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, Craig Campobasso is a very good friend of mine. And Craig was closer into this than I was. But Stranger in the Pentagon, Craig tells me he's still there, Valiant Thor. And Valiant Thor landed in Pennsylvania back in the 50s, I guess. I've tried to fill some of these things that I don't know about. So he and the police ended up taking him to the Pentagon. They dropped him off at the Pentagon. He walked right into the Pentagon. Valiant Thor offered Eisenhower, we can give you, let's see if I get this right. We can offer you, food and energy free. And Eisenhower turned him down because he said, because if we take this technology you're giving us, it will put so many people that won't have anything to do, but you know, they have an easy life. We will have wars on our hands that you can't imagine. So I've been fascinated by this whole thing about Valiant Thor for a long time. And Craig said, no, it's true. And Eisenhower turned him down. And just recently I met with somebody, I'm really getting off on a tangent here, that when Eisenhower was at Edwards Air Force Base, when the Pleiadians landed, he was there. I can't remember his name now. He was a general. At any rate, so he said, oh yes, absolutely. The ship landed at Edwards Air Force Base. And Eisenhower drove out there, and they had a meeting, and went on for a long time. But he didn't say what was done with Eisenhower. But he said, "Oh yeah, it absolutely happened. He was there. He was a general. I can't remember his name, but so anyway."
Right. Now, one final thing before we close out, you know, you always hear of that extraterrestrials can, you know, they only intervene in human affairs to a certain point, the Prime Directive from Star right. Trek. Right. I'm wondering what's your thoughts on that. If, you know, we do have a very uncertain future ahead. A lot of people are right. concerned and right. scared about the future. Yep. And there's even thoughts of, you know, what if we do find out that there are extraterrestrials, and will they be on our side? So I'm just wondering, what's your thoughts on that as we close out?
Okay. How many? We got a few minutes. About 5 minutes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Two things. Whitley Strieber evidently was just told that by extraterrestrials, we won't come in. We won't come in until we are humanity's last chance. So that gives you a pretty good clue right there. Bill Hamilton, who was the top UFO researcher in the world, Bill and I were best friends. In fact, oh boy, I could tell stories about me and Bill. But anyway, so Bill interviewed this guy that had just had human extraterrestrial contact, and that the Earth guy asked the extraterrestrial, he said, "Why don't you come in and stop us before we kill all of us? We kill ourselves off and destroy the planet." And the extraterrestrial some people go nuts about me when I talk about this. The extraterrestrial told him, "We can't, because whatever we do, you do as a result of our intervention in your affairs, we will get blamed for it. We will get penalized for it." You can imagine if extraterrestrials, they're afraid of us. They're afraid of what we'll do. That's pretty much what. But this is something that I've been working on for years now. Long stories. But I have met extraterrestrials. I didn't talk to them, but they were I knew they were extraterrestrials. The tall whites and a Swede. Well, the woman was a tall white and the guy was a Swede. So I didn't talk to him, but you know, I was right there with him. So anyway, I have been very close, and I've chased extraterrestrials for years. I said, come on. You know, they were always two steps ahead of me. I said, come on, let's meet me somewhere and have a cup of coffee and talk for a while. They never did, but I can tell you one thing for certain. If you're somewhere and you're thinking about extraterrestrials, they can read your thoughts. They will hear your thoughts. The Travel Channel did a reenactment of an experience that I had by extraterrestrials reading my mind. So it was proven to me, to myself, that extraterrestrials can read your mind. If you're thinking of them, you will get their attention, and they will listen to your thoughts.
Yeah, and something you said earlier that kind of really rings true to me with my personal contact experience, which I experienced through a form of meditation, was the psychic communication that was instantaneous in the form of images and emotions that could be interpreted as words and language. And I thought that was really spot on in how you, a great description of how the communication went. It was very interesting.
You know, there's a guy. I'm just getting into this now, but I've suspected this for years. They're just on the verge of being proving that we are surrounded by creatures from space. They're all around us all the time. They're a plasma-like being, and this guy. Well, I won't go into my notes here, but they've got camera equipment now that can see them. And I've you know these. Those that stuff when the tether broke the 17-mile tether broke from
yeah
the
I know
space
what you're t- yeah yeah
yeah and all those things that some of them are 5 miles across, those are the creatures, and they come down here amongst us. I have photographs of them that were taken with a regular camera by accident, and they're around us all the time, but we can't see them. And they're very close to being able to prove that these things are here. They're very close to it, probably within months. So this is going to be interesting. They're a plasma-like creature that we can't see them, but they're here. Lots of them.
And that's so interesting. And we have so much more that we could get into. So I'd love to have you back on sometime soon. But before you head out, let everyone know if they're interested in finding out more about your books, information about you. What's the best way that they can do so?
Well, Merging Dimensions, you can either go on Amazon or my website, tomdongo.com, and you can get Merging Dimensions for 30% off plus shipping. You have to pay the shipping. But it's a bestseller, Merging Dimensions, my new edition of Merging Dimension. It's all about the Bradshaw Ranch. And I have three of my books are out of print forever. So, and the rest of them are on Amazon, by Merging Dimensions. People love it. People love it.
Awesome. Yes, I'll leave a link to that in the description. Tom, thank you so much again for coming on, and I'd love to talk to you again soon. And for everyone else, have a great evening.